I'm Katie. I'm still an alcoholic, and I'll do this short and sweet. You know, I hear people say all the time that, you know, drinking was fun, then drinking was fun with consequences, then drinking was nothing but consequences. That was not my experience from the very first time I took a sip of alcohol, which was 12, and in my opinion, they should totally outlaw Boone's Strawberry Hill, because that seems to be a theme, Boone's and Mad Dog. From the very first time that I took my first sip of alcohol, I knew that I had found a solution. That became my solution for any problem that I had. You know, I could tell you about all the other substances that I did and all the other solutions I found, but the fact of the matter is that this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and there is yet to this day a problem. I haven't had a problem that I couldn't solve with these steps and AA. I have a girlfriend that she always says whenever I call her and I'm bitching about something, she says there's a step for that and hangs up on me. And that has been my experience. There's a step for every problem that I face today. You know, drinking was never fun. I know now what fun feels like, what real, true joy feels like, and it doesn't feel anything like the fun I used to have drinking. Drinking was my job. It was what I did. And anyone who stood in the way of me and my job, that was the only job I took seriously. Anyone that stood in the way of me and my job, I'd find a way to run you over. And AA has given me a new way of life. It's given me everything I have. I mean, there's no way around it. It's given me everything I have. And every once in a while when I get in that poor me, where like my life isn't good enough, I sit back and look about how amazing my life truly is. And all of that is because of AA. So thank you for letting me share that. And you're welcome. And I have asked, reminder, the group has asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off. That's twice. Phones are off, people. And refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing, unless you gotta go to the bathroom, like, because I gotta go to the bathroom all the time.
Thanks for sharing.
No problem. I'm making a caveat here. So the speaker, I'm gonna introduce her. My speaker tonight, or the speaker tonight, is Miss Julie. And someone once told me when I first got sober, there was a saying in West Palm where I got sober, if you don't think you have the best sponsor, get a new one. And I am glad to say today that I truly believe that I have the best sponsor. She's my sponsor. And, you know, there are days when I think that no one can understand the craziness that is going through my head. And every single time she nails it. Mm-hmm. I don't even have to explain it. And she's already got a solution for me. And for that, I am eternally grateful. I don't want to start to cry, but when I moved up here, I probably will. When I moved up here, it was really hard for me, you know, moving from Key West and my home group and all the people that I knew and loved and starting over, you know, in AA, it's difficult. And she always made me feel, from the very first day, she made me feel welcome. And that's a true gift. And I now try to do the same. I often fail, but it's a progress, not perfection. So with that, I give you Julie.
Okay, now you can talk.
I'm gonna kick those chips. My name's Julie, I'm an alcoholic. Woo wee. I'm a co-chair at every meeting that I'm at, so that's why I was telling her how to do it. It's a gift. My name's Julie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 25th, 1990. I know it's amazing. I only look 30.
Yeah.
But I got sober when I was 27. I'm going to be 51 this month. And I know I look amazing. And that's what a lifetime of oily skin and acne will get you. My mom kept saying, you're going to be appreciative of that one day. And I was like, I don't think I'll live that long, but I finally made it there. So anyway, alcoholism. I do have a touch of it. And I've been thinking about some things in my early life that kind of were an indicator that I might have a problem. I've mentioned this to some of my friends and my husband lately, that I remember when I was a little girl, my mom, I was sick, and I didn't want to go to school, or I was sick. I don't remember if I was sick or if I was sick. And my mom said, go take a Sudafed. Mm-hmm. And I was like in third or fourth grade. So I went, and I got four Sudafeds, because some is good, more is better. And I took four Sudafeds into my whatever 70-pound body. And I went to school, and I was, like, passing out, and they took me to the nurse's office, and my mom had to come get me and everything. And she's like, how many Sudafed did you take? And I was like, four. She was like, no, you can't take that many. I was like, well, now you tell me. But it just never occurred to me, one, first of all, to follow directions, you know, just take one Sudafed. And second of all, that I always needed more, you know. And another thing, a lot of younger people here, probably you, don't remember this time, but there was a time when we had four channels. There was the three major networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and then PBS. And once a year, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer would come on. And by God, if you wanted to see Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you were there Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, and you watched it, and you enjoyed every minute of it if you were me. And the other thing that they had that came on every, you know, once a year, I think it was in the summer, was The Wizard of Oz. And, oh God, The Wizard of Oz, you know, I wished I lived in the merry old land of Oz. I wanted to be there. And I really got fascinated with Judy Garland, and I don't know how many 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds read Judy Garland biographies over and over again, but if you know anything about Judy Garland, like, they had her hopped up on speed when she was 10 years old, trying to make her skinny, and then she couldn't go to sleep, and so, and then she's an alcoholic, and a train wreck of a life, you know, really famous and could sing like nobody else, but she was a complete junkie and an alcoholic, and I loved reading about her climb to fame and the descent and all, I just seediness of it all. And in my young life, that's, you know, kind of my favorite thing to read. So I think that's kind of indicative of, I wouldn't write. And like, come on, Mom. My mom read the book first and she let me read it anyway, you know? So, but whatever. I was reading. She was probably glad about that. So, because I wasn't doing my schoolwork, that's for sure. So I don't have a huge history of alcoholism in my family. My parents both, they drank some. And I probably saw my mom drunk more than my dad because he was in the Army and he was back and forth to Korea and Vietnam and stuff like that. And my mom and her girlfriend would drink cream de coco, which I never did drink cream de coco, and milk. They would make chocolate milks and we would get, I'd watch them drink and we'd watch All in the Family back when it was really like a brand new show, 1971 I think. And my dad had told me later in life, he said that he realized that you get a ration in the Army once a week. They would, back then they would give you like a bottle, and my dad said that he realized that if he had a hangover the next day that he needed to stop drinking. And one day he realized he had a hangover and he stopped. Not forever, but on that tour of duty, he stopped. And I really only saw him drunk maybe 5 times in my whole life. But I do have alcoholism in my family. I'm related to a famous alcoholic who you may know or may not know. James Agee was my dad's cousin. He died while my dad was still very young. But he's a notorious alcoholic. I have a cousin. I have 2 cousins that died from this disease. And their surviving sister, well, I'm not going to even say that because it's not my story, but I love her very much. I'm really glad that I have her in my life. So there's some genetic predisposition. Oh, my grandma Reese, I have memories of things that I think they're my memories, but they're really, like, my brother told me the story so many times that it became a memory for me. I don't know if any of you have those, but anyway, Grandma was a drinker. You didn't ever drink out of her coffee cup because you never knew what you were going to get. And not like I was drinking coffee when she was alive. She died when I was 8. But my brother told me that, you know, she'd be making our breakfast drinking Schlitz. I have no recollection of that, but she was my favorite grandma. I loved her so much. She was so awesome, and she was a pretty cool old lady. So anyway, I got some in the family, but I also know that alcoholism is not just something that's passed down. It's also got an element of your environment that you're in, and I really like the environment around drinking, so I should get drunk. I started drinking at 12 or 13. I was drunk at the time, so I don't really remember. Ernest and Julio Gallo Rhine wine. My dad gave me a glass. He was probably prepping me for adulthood. He's like, we'll get him started at home. She'll be safe. I drank half a gallon of wine because he didn't hide it. That was my first drunk. And when I woke up the next day, I couldn't wait to do it over again. And I really couldn't wait to do it again. And I did at every given opportunity. I did use other substances. I'm not going to go into that. Let's just say that when you're 13 and you haven't even developed breasts yet, they're not going to serve you at the bar or the liquor store. You know, you kind of got to work it out so that you can get some other stuff in there. And I did that. And I remember it was so important. Like, I don't know if anybody else had this experience, but when you first start drinking beer, like you get about halfway through the can and it's very filling, you know, when you're a little kid and foamy and whatever. And so I remember, like, these were my marks of maturity, was being able to drink a whole beer and be able to throw it out the window and have it go clink, clink instead of thud, thud. Like, that was a marker in my maturity. Finding out about happy hour and ladies' nights. First, though, I had to find out about fake IDs. Later on, I found out about fake IDs, and I started frequenting the bars when I was still in high school. I just wanted the next thing that was going to help numb me out. And I think about that feeling of I had an itch deep in my brain, and the only thing that would scratch it for me was alcohol and pot. And I know, I'm sorry, but it's just such a big part of my story. So I really did do that. I didn't give him an opportunity. I was never much of a scholar, and I really hit the skids with that. But I did make it out of high school. I had some menial jobs. There's a seat right here. So I had some menial jobs, and then when I graduated high school, I did some, I'm a little disoriented because my friend just came in. I didn't know you were going to be here. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah. So where was I? Anybody? Can you help me? Mary Jo, it's your job.
Huh?
Big IDs, good drink. Oh, what I was going to tell you is I had some menial jobs along the way, but my dad got me a job at Harris Corporation doing assembly, and I helped build the first GPS satellite.
Wow.
You are welcome. I didn't know what a GPS satellite was. I was so screwed up all the time. I'd go to the bar at lunch. I was smoking on the way to work every day. I'm surprised the damn thing works today. And I know every time you get led astray, you just think about me. Although that's the one I built's really, really old. I'm sure it's space junk. I'm sure it doesn't work anymore. But yeah, so anyway, I was working at that job and getting pointers from my bosses about how to conceal the smell of whatever I was doing on my lunch break so I wouldn't get caught. And I took them to heart. They said Big Red was the gum to chew to kind of cover it up, and they weren't going to turn me in because they were doing similar things to what I was doing. But what they weren't doing was doing illegal things behind a chain link fence. I was bright, right? I was on my lunch break behind a chain link fence with 13 of my closest friends, whose names I can only recall one of. I ended up getting arrested on my lunch break working for a defense contractor, and I had a secret clearance, not a top secret clearance. I had a secret clearance, and I am pretty sure I can't get one anymore after that. And that was my first big run-in with the law. And I remember it didn't even occur to me to think about how that impacted my family or anybody else. All I wanted was to do more the next day. That's all I wanted. And I ended up getting another job in the same business. I didn't get fired. Nobody got fired. It's a long story, but I ended up getting another job in defense contracting. And after the Challenger explosion, for those of you who are less than 25, that was when one of the space shuttles blew up. So I ended up losing my job after that. And so after that, I didn't have any structure in my life. I was unemployed. Most of Brevard County was unemployed. And eventually, once my unemployment ran out, I started working and I started doing construction cleaning. And then I couldn't really do that anymore because I was so wasted. I was so high all the time. And I got this one contract to clean big houses on Tortoise Island, if you know where that is in Brevard County. Where's the Brevard County guy?
Route 1.
You're a Brevard County guy? You? What's up? Tortoise Island. So I would have to climb these big ladders, and I'd be super screwed up. And oh, my God, climb outside. I'd be shaking and trying to wash windows. And then I thought, you know, this is a little too taxing. And I started just living with guys that really liked me and would take care of me. And when I came to my first AA meeting, I remember there was a girl. Okay, wait a minute. Do I want to get into that? Well, let's just say I lived with guys that I liked, that they liked me, and I was really trying to love them because I knew if I didn't love them that I was not being a very good person. But in the summer of 1990, I started getting real nervous, and I just couldn't drink enough. I couldn't get enough alcohol and drugs in me to simmer down. And I ended up having to go to Circles of Care. Anybody from Brevard County been to Circles of Care besides me? Yay! I remember they gave me this form, and this is how denial is. They gave me this big pack of papers and, you know, name, address, Social Security, and there's a graph at the bottom. And while I did do substances other than alcohol, I really only did two substances other than alcohol, and one made you go slow that I liked, and then there was another one that made you go fast, and I didn't like that after a couple of years and I quit doing it. But at this graph, on this graph, one down one side it says, do you use alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, barbiturates, amphetamines? I didn't know what barbiturates and amphetamines were, and if you don't, it's okay, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. all these other things that I didn't even know what they were. And then across the top of the graph it says, rarely, never, rarely, occasionally, once a week, which is occasionally to me. Once a week is just occasionally. I don't know what they meant by occasionally. And then, you know, daily, every day or whatever. And I lied my fanny off on that. I lied and lied and lied. And then you turn the page, and at the top of the next page it says, do you think you have a problem with any of these substances? And, you know, in my heart of hearts, I knew that I had lied. And I was like, a really smart psychologist that designed this thing because I felt so guilty. But I lied, and I turned it in, and they started sending me to this head shrinker, and she recommended that I start coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. I knew a few people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of them was my drug dealer. Sorry, honey. And my husband's a bit of an AA purist, you know. I don't think he just says other things, and I just can't get away with that because I smoked so much my drug dealer had gotten involved with other substances that I judged him very harshly for because I didn't do them. so I had to be better than him, right? Yeah. So I was like, yeah. So anyway, I had heard that he had gotten sober, and I was trying to control my drinking while I was going to this therapist, and I would do the one beer pickup. I'd get out of Brevard Community College on Wickham Road. I'd go to the end of Post Road in US 1, and I'd buy a beer because I was only going to have the one, right? And then I'd get to O'Galley and A1A, and there was an Exxon station there, and their coolers were really, really cold. So I'd get another one. And I lived in Floridana Beach. I almost lived down to Sebastian Inlet. Wow. And I would pick up one at just about every store I'd go to. And then, rocket scientist that I am, or as Nina says, rock scientist, I would go back and forth to the Town Star at the flashing light on A1A over and over and over again and buy one beer at a time. And the guy would say, why don't you just get a six pack? And I said, you don't understand, I'll drink it all. And he goes, you're doing it anyway. And I'm like, you work at a Town Star, so screw you. You work at a convenience store, you might want to broaden your resume. So, because I'm like that. And don't look at me, look at you. And so I'm in the middle of my Town Star run one day, and I've got 1 foot in the front seat of my Pinto and 1 foot on the concrete. I'm finishing up the box, because I barely made it to the house before I had turned back around to get this next beer. And I'm down in this beer, and I look, and here comes my dealer, who's clean and sober. He's about 6'2", his name's Rich. And I, for years, I've loved him like a brother. I wish I saw him more. He's not in the program anymore. And it was like the sun shone out of him. You know, it talks about in the Big Book where Ebby comes to see Bill, one of our co-founders, and he said that he could see that he was different, that he was inwardly rearranged. And God knows, Rich needed it, right? So that's my thought. I'm like, whoo, here he comes, you know, thank God. But I was embarrassed because I knew that I wasn't acting normal around alcohol. And I said to him, I was like, you know, I heard you got sober. And he said, I'm going to get my 90-day chip. He was on his way to the Melbourne Men's Group. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And eventually, I don't know how long after that, I ended up calling him. I mean, like I said, I was hammered, so I wasn't real, my memory's still not good, but it was really bad then. And I ended up going to Alcoholics Anonymous at the Triangle Group. It was on Babcock Street back then. And my first meeting was the homeless hooker biker meeting. If you're any of those, that's okay. Because I didn't think I was, but I totally was every one of those things. But I enjoyed the comparison, you know. I wasn't like those people. So I go to this meeting. Rich says he's going to meet me there. People from my college are there, which freaked me out. And they said they were young people, but they were not. They said, oh, this is the young people's group. And I was like, you need to quit saying that because you're not young anymore. But there were some young people there. And the first girl that shared, people say that you can scare people out of Alcoholics Anonymous by what you share, and you need to be very careful. I'm an alcoholic, and I need a solution. And it did scare me when I first got there, but I came back because I knew Rich. I knew a guy from my bar named Gary S. that he had gotten sober. I saw him a few days after I eventually got sober. But anyway, this girl was a prostitute, and she wanted to know if she could stay sober and turn tricks. That was the topic at my first meeting.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I'm better than her. I am better than her, you know? And I was like, awesome, I don't belong here. And then there was a girl who had some sobriety, and she was living in her car. And I was like, I'm better than her. And then there was some guy talking about doing drugs, like I have tonight. But I was like, I'm better than him because I didn't do that drug. And And so it was the day before Labor Day, and I went out drinking the next day. But eventually, 3 weeks later, I came back, and like I said, September 25th, 1990 is my sobriety date. And I think about my early recovery. I came in, I decided that I knew alcohol and drugs were like the core issue of problems in my life. And I couldn't really get a handle on that I had other issues when I first got here. Putting down the drink, for an alcoholic of my type, putting down a drink is like, it's a miracle. It was removed from me. I realized that I couldn't drink alcohol safely again. And thank God I never did. And I was vulnerable and scared. And just open enough to hear a little bit at those first meetings about that I needed to find some kind of higher power, that I needed to read the book. I didn't buy the books. The books were given to me because I couldn't afford them. I could always afford to go out drinking, but I could not afford this book. I think when I got sober was $5.65, but I couldn't wing it, you know, because I was cheap and selfish. And I read the books. I read the books through and through. I read the big book through like three times in the first month I was sober. And I loved it. I read the 12 and 12. I read the traditions before I had 90 days. I didn't retain them, but I read them. And I just remember thinking, you know, how old this thing is, you know. It started in 35, Bill got sober. But the book was written in 1939. And while the language is antiquated, I really related. If you're new and you haven't read the story about the jaywalker, I really recommend it. It really, really convinced me that I was an alcoholic. And it talks about, you know, the guy runs out in front of a trolley and he gets hit. And I'm like, I would do the same thing over and over and over again, expecting it to be different. I kept drinking, looking at the bottom of my glass going, I am going to throw up if I drink this, and toss it back and order another one, and I would throw up. I was just insane around alcohol. So I did the not drinking thing pretty easy when I got here, and I'm sorry if that's not your story. You know, I know that it's really tough. But I was blessed that way. But what I didn't see was that I really needed to turn my will and my life over to a higher power and maybe take some suggestions, get a sponsor. I had sponsors in name only. I would ask people to sponsor me that would not call me on my crap. And so when I got ingrained in this group and I started making friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, within a very short amount of time, I was dating a lot. I was having deep, meaningful relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous with some rapidity between partners. You know, I was just like, when I look back now, I realize that you took the alcoholic out of the bar, but I was still doing bar behavior sober. And over time, that really got me in trouble. When I was 18 months sober, you know, and I'm not going to do a fifth step from the podium or a 10th step. And if anybody wants to talk to me about any particulars in my story, you're like, what is that thing she won't tell us? You can come up and I'll tell you individually, but I'm not going to say it from the podium. But I got myself in so much trouble sober, and I didn't have alcohol to blame. I had never worked the steps. I read the books. I tried to retain stuff. I would parrot things other people said. I read them a lot because I wanted you to think that I knew what I was talking about. And once I hit the second bottom in recovery, I did work the steps. And what a blessing that was for me. It took me like a whole year to even really get that there was a power greater than myself. And it started with just the group of drunks, you know, and that was fine for me. Alcoholics Anonymous was my higher power for a very long time. And by the It's not AA approved, but it is a great book written by an AA member. It's called A New Pair of Glasses, where he talks about his relationship with God. I'm glad some other people have read it.
Yeah.
You radical, non-conference approved literature readers. I have your name.
Rebel.
I have your name. But it helped introduce me to a higher power that I could really start to get to know. And when I started actually praying the third step prayer with a sponsor and working the steps, I learned this phrase, and I've tried to find it in the book, and I can't find it, but it says, where other people were concerned, we had to remove the word blame from our speech, which was radical. And even today, sometimes it's radical, isn't it, honey? Because I blame you a lot. But fortunately, I got some stuff to deal with that, too. So I started learning about how to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and how to live with my family and how to actually implement these steps in my life. The good news is that I did it poorly so that I could do it better the next time. I could do it better the time after that. And I tell this story all the time because it was really the most radical, eye-opening thing that happened in my psyche and my inventory. The real light bulb went on is when I was telling my sponsor this fifth step, and I'm crying about my dad and how terrible he is. Could you hand me that other garter? There's water under your chair. And how terrible my dad was and all this stuff. Thanks. And I am crying, like sobbing. And my dad didn't molest me or anything, but I remember the phrase I said was, and the innocence of my childhood was taken from me. And I'm crying. And she's like, how old were you? I was like, I was 8. So terrible what he did. Isn't he a mean man? I didn't say this out loud, but this is my demeanor. And then my sponsor looked at me, and she said, the words that changed my life forever. She said, how old are you now? And I was like, 32? What the hell do you care? You know, I'm like, well, what does that mean? She's like, you act like an 8-year-old child. You're walking around with the resentments towards your family from when you were a little bitty kid. She's like, grow up. She didn't say that mean. She was really nice about it. But essentially, I really got the message that I had been walking around as an adult with a child's mentality. Now, those of you who know me today, you know I'm childlike. And yes, I am childish from time to time. But I don't live in those places in my life anymore. It was my life. You had wronged me, and I was going to have a chip on my shoulder. And by the grace of God in this program, I've learned how to take responsibility for my emotions. I've learned how to take responsibility for my actions. I'm not always too quick on the upkeep on that sometimes, but I have the option, and I have sponsorship in my life today. So that's just a little window into some inventory that I've done. But what I found in doing the inventory out of the big book is that I always have a part in any situation in my life. And the part is, in any resentment in my life, and the part is, I have a resentment. A resentment will kill me. It will cause me to go back out and drink again. Excuse me. I just had some really good Latin Asian fusion food. And, pardon me. So I learned that while I may not have 100% responsibility in a certain situation, I may only have 1% responsibility in a certain situation. But for my recovery, I have to take 100% responsibility for my 1%. It's my 1% I have to work on. In the big book, it says, where the other person was involved, we had to disregard them entirely. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. But I have alcoholism, and all I need is to take 1% of their 99% and start focusing on that, and I'm going to be out of control. Not necessarily picking up a drink. I all of a sudden the meetings aren't as good, and so and so needed to tighten up on their chairmanship, you know. And I know who's a dry drunk and who's not, and the judgment and all that stuff. And it's not a good place for me to be. So I got to take responsibility for my, and trust me, most of the time it's more than 1%. don't get me wrong. And then in our steps, we go on, you know, we're working on these character defects. We have character defects. I have a lot of character defects. What the good news is today is that I know that I have them, and some of them have been removed to a greater or lesser degree. I do not sleep around anymore. But there was a day when that wouldn't have mattered, you know, that I was married. Getting into steps 8 and 9, there were amends that I had to make. I tried to make some amends when I first came to the rooms. I went from step 1 to step 9. Mm-hmm. If you're new, don't ever do that. Because then you got to make amends for making amends. I did. That was my story. And so, I mean, if you don't hear anything else I say tonight, please hear this. Please get a sponsor that has a sponsor that works the steps out of the big book. It's been the thing that's changed my life more than anything else besides putting down a drink. It's altered my life in a way I can't even describe. I know that for a long time I had that chip on my shoulder, even though to greater or lesser degrees during my sobriety with my dad. And I talk about my dad a lot because you guys gave me a gift by your example. And my sponsor would say to me, that's kind of that whole taking responsibility for your part, is we're not going to worry about what kind of dad your dad is. We're going to worry about what kind of daughter you are. But just my mere existence should bring light into your life, you know, as was my thought. But that's not true. I had to start being a good daughter. I know, it's amazing. So we sat down and we talked about what's a good daughter? What are the characteristics of a good daughter? What are the characteristics of a good sister? What are the characteristics of a good friend? What's the characteristics of a good Alcoholics Anonymous member? And we really started looking at that stuff. And then slowly, glacially, I tried to implement that stuff. One thing that I did when I would contact my dad, I'd pray before I contacted my dad. That's a switch. And then I would remember who he was. My dad was John A.G. Jr., retired lieutenant colonel, not Ward Cleaver. And for you young people in here... There is no modern day equivalent. I don't think there's a modern day equivalent. But, you know, it wasn't all, he was who he was. And I could love him for who he was and right where he was because I didn't expect him to be somebody else. I learned how to let him be who he was. And I also learned that I didn't have to be a doormat. He wasn't always delightful. And if he was less than delightful, I had the right to say, you know, Daddy, I think I'm going to get off the phone. I remember one time he said a derogatory term to me, and I said, Daddy, you know, you just can't talk like that anymore. And I'll never forget what he said. He sounded like he was 5 years old. He goes, I know. I didn't have to beat him up or anything like that, which is my standard. I didn't have to do that. And our relationship became better and better over the years. When my husband and I did meet... about 10 years ago, and we got engaged immediately, which was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun, and then it wasn't a lot of fun. I remember I called my dad to tell him, you know, we were getting married, and he goes, what color dress are you going to wear? I was like, black and red. I'm going to wear black and red. But, I just kept remembering who I was talking to. And by the time we got to the end of the phone call, he sounded like he was 5 years old again, and he said, who's going to walk you down the aisle? you know? I was like, you are. And he did, you know? So, somewhere along the line, I eventually got to step 12. And I just want to also make a comment about people talk about living amends. And if you do that, that's fine. I'm not here to, like, rain on your parade or anything. But it was explained by a speaker one time that that term kind of inspires guilt or something in me that I can never make up. Well, no, you never can make up. But what we can do with a one-day-at-a-time program is try to practice the principle of the 12th step, which is to practice these principles in all our affairs. If we've made our amends and we've made our restitution and that part's taken care of, the living amends is more, in my mind, is more about trying to practice these principles in all my affairs. Because if I'm doing that, that's pretty good amends. And it's obviously imperfectly done by me. But anyway, I got the gift of sponsorship. When I was about 3.5 years sober, my mom got terminally ill. And we knew she was dying. Nobody, surprisingly, had asked me to sponsor them up to that point. And my sponsor told me that I was completely self-absorbed and selfish, and that if I didn't try to help somebody else, I was going to get drunk. And at first I was mad and indignant, and then on reflection I realized that he was right. I was completely obsessed with myself and my feelings around this event in my life. And he recommended that I pray to God for a sponsee, and within 24 hours, I had two. Now, I was sober 3.5, almost 4 years, and I didn't have one, and then I had two in 24 hours. One, I'm pretty sure he put her up to it, but the other girl, there was no accounting for that. And what happened with sponsorship for me is that it changed my life in a whole nother way. I heard a speaker say one time that, you know, you work the steps, you read the book, you do your writings, you pray, whatever, but then when you start to sponsor somebody, it's like you do it for real. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like driving a car with a baby on board. When you're in the car, you're kind of cavalier driving by yourself, but then if you have a baby, something you cherish in your car, you drive differently. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of that way with the steps for me, because I am way more diligent in the steps when I'm working with somebody else. I'm remembering things. I was talking to somebody about page 68. If you haven't come around for a while, some people call it the fear page. I call it the courage page because it tells us how to have courage in the face of fear. Mm-hmm. And I'll be damned if I didn't have to talk about that 3 or 4 more times the same day. And it just goes like that. And I'm like, oh, fear. I am in the world to play the role that God assigns for me. I'm not in the world just to satisfy myself. I'm in the world to play the role he assigns. I have lots of roles. I have a kind of a job, but you know, I'm a massage therapist, and right now I'm freelancing, which means very little work. And I'm a wife. I'm an AA member. I'm a member at my church. I ended up going back to church after many, many years in sobriety. I'm a friend, and I have great friends today. I have all kinds of roles in my life today, and I have to go to my higher power to learn how to be active in those roles and to stay out of fear. Because if I'm looking just to satisfy my own needs as opposed to trying to play the role God assigns for me, I am in discontent. One of the things that I really had a hard time with when I first came in, and well, for the first 12 years that I came in, was I always was looking for somebody to complete me. It was normal and natural for me to want to have a partner in life, but the way that I pursued it and the motivations that I had for pursuing that was all askew. And when I hit a bottom with that in sobriety, I remember, and thank God. God saved me from myself so many times in those situations. But when I finally quit trying to make other people my higher power, and I really, really turned to my relationship with God, it was a beautiful transformation in my life. And about 2.5 years after that happened is when Ray came into my life. And while our union hasn't been smooth, those of you who know me and know him and know my story, and Marilyn was at our wedding, and Gypsy's reading his e-reader. You have to tell me about it later. We got married, and the beginning of our marriage was really rough. It was so rough that after, was it 4.5 years? We had a 93-day divorce. We were divorced for 93 days. And let me tell you, it was painful. And it was kind of like I didn't want to come and talk about it, but at the same time, I knew that I had to be honest in my home group about what was going on in my life. I didn't always talk about the fact that I was divorced or getting divorced, but I was devastated. And I got to be devastated right here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys loved me through that. And I'm talking way too long. I just want to say that the life that I have today is beautiful beyond measure. In the 11th step, the prayer and meditation that Ray and I do in the morning, we read a AA meditation book, Daily Reflections. We read one that pertains more specifically to our faith, and then we read another one that pertains to marriage. And I remember I was like, I don't know how to be married. I don't know how to be married. And I can tell you, there's a lot of evidence to support that. But I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous how to be a better wife, how to be a better person. And all of that's important in relation to alcoholism because I am internally rearranged. It says in the spiritual experience that, you know, we have to have a psychic change sufficient to overcome alcoholism. That's not the exact quote, but I've had that psychic change, and I've had many more along the years. And I hope that one day at a time, you'll see why I say, when people ask me, how are you doing? And I always say, I haven't had a cocktail all day. And it's 5 to 9. I was plowed at 5 to 9. So anyway, I'm sorry I talked so long, and thank you for letting me be your speaker.